From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a journalist tells us what he thinks is going wrong in his profession. We talk with James Fallows about his new book, Breaking the News, How the Media Undermine American Democracy. One of his targets is the new breed of political talk show where celebrity journalists talk about politics as if it were sports. Also today, a satirical look at politics and the media. We talk with Al Franken about his new book called Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations. Franken is a former writer and cast member of Saturday Night Live. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A fire whipped to blowtorch intensity by strong winds raced through a 10-story apartment house in Chicago before dawn today, killing four people. Nearly four dozen others were injured. Some jumped from as high as five stories up to try to escape the flames. One firefighter managed to catch an 8-year-old girl who was dropped from one of the floors above him. German authorities have detained three suspects in connection with a fire at a refugee shelter that killed at least 10 people. NPR's Deidre Berger has more.
Police became suspicious after noticing the young men last night walking near the site of the fire in the city of Lübeck, but released them after questioning. During the day, the three suspects, a juvenile and an 18 and 21-year-old, were taken into police custody in their hometown in northeast Germany. Prosecutors are investigating charges of murder and arson. However, police in Lübeck said the cause of the fire is still uncertain, leaving open the possibility of an accident. Criminal investigators have not yet been able to enter the badly damaged building. Rescue teams continue to work clearing debris and searching for further victims. Hundreds of people have gathered spontaneously at the site of the fire to express sympathy with the victims. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
The aide who accidentally discovered Hillary Rodham Clinton's long-sought law firm billing records told a Senate panel today that the documents suddenly appeared on a table in the residence section of the White House. Carolyn Huber told the Senate Whitewater Committee that someone must have left the records there deliberately. The room was accessible to several White House employees as well as the Clintons. At the time the records were found, criminal prosecutors and government regulators had been asking for them for nearly 2 years. A new study by the liberal watchdog group Citizen Action charges that surging political action committee contributions have given corporate donors and special interests unprecedented clout on Capitol Hill. NPR's Kathleen Schalk reports.
Citizen Action says in 1993, PACs with interests in particular environmental, worker safety, banking, tax, and health care legislation donated only slightly more to Democrats than to Republicans and gave $9.8 million to all the members of the House combined. In the first 10 months of 1995, those same PACs gave more than that, about $10 million, to Republican House members alone. Democrats collected only about a third that much. Citizen Action's Ira Arluck.
Of the top 50 recipients, 44 were Republicans.
Arluck argues that the current budget impasse reflects the sway of business PACs over lawmakers who might otherwise have reached an agreement with the White House. But some critics of the report say it's the Republican agenda that's attracted the contributions, not the other way around. In Washington, I'm Kathleen Schalk reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 30 points. This is NPR. Students and teachers in Nebraska who were stranded at their schools by the blizzard sweeping the Plain States were finally driven home today in four-wheel drive vehicles. The snow has stopped in some areas, but conditions are still bad, with wind chill factors as low as 86 degrees below zero. Hundreds of miles of interstate highway have been closed down. Millionaire publisher Steve Forbes presented his proposal for a flat tax before the New Hampshire legislature today. In many recent polls in that state, Forbes has placed a strong second for the Republican presidential nomination behind frontrunner Bob Dole. Lita Hartman of New Hampshire Public Radio has more.
Forbes touted his plan for a 17% flat tax with no deductions as the way to encourage economic growth and individual opportunity. He described the present tax system in terms that could be used to describe a vampire that was guaranteed to please New Hampshire's anti-tax lawmakers.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's only one thing to do with this monstrosity. You can't reform it, You can't trim it around the edges. The only thing to do is to scrap it, kill it, drive a stake through the heart, bury it, and hope it never rises again to terrorize the American people.
Forbes got a warm reception from the Republican-dominated legislature. Some critics, however, said his flat tax plan and his emphasis on making individuals provide for their own needs would hurt the disadvantaged. For National Public Radio, I'm Lita Hartman in Concord, New Hampshire.
Under pressure from the Justice Department, a Portsmouth, Virginia funeral home has agreed to stop assessing extra charges for embalming the bodies of AIDS victims. The settlement was reached under the Americans with Disabilities Act. The funeral home has agreed to reimburse and pay damages to 9 families who were charged the extra $300 fee. Federal rules require morticians to treat all bodies as if they have infectious disease. As a result, the Justice Department said there's no legal basis for charging more for AIDS victims. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With the rise of TV's political talk shows, like the McLaughlin Group, the Brinkley Show, Crossfire, and the Capital Gang, more journalists are turning into celebrities. James Fallows doesn't think that's a very healthy development, and that isn't the only thing that troubles him about the current state of journalism in this country. He says the media have lost sight of or have been pushed away from their central values. Fallows is a journalist himself. He's Washington editor of The Atlantic Monthly and a commentator on NPR's Morning Edition. His new book, Breaking the News, is an attempt to explain how and why the values of journalists have changed and how those changes are affecting American politics. I asked him if there was something that pushed him over the edge and led him to write this critique of his own profession.
It was late in 1994, a little less than a year and a half ago. My wife and I were getting ready on a Saturday evening to go out to see one of our son's high school football games, and in the background I had one of these Washington journalist talk shows on with 4 or 5 people saying, well, did the president have a good week? No, he had a bad week, but, you know, what about Bosnia? And hey, what about China or whatever? Sort of flinging around these episodes in the part of the world that I knew these people didn't know anything about, just because I knew them as people, and they were having these very authoritative-sounding pronouncements about them. And as I was watching them, I thought, this is just embarrassing. I am ashamed to be thought of as in the same business as these people, and I'm ashamed that our business is increasingly promoting this as the example of success. And so I thought, I have to try to do something about this, to make a pitch of what it is in the culture of today's mainstream journalism that is producing results that I find embarrassing, you know, and destructive to the country. Let me mention one other episode which also pushed me over the brink. It was when I was seeing, it occurred in a movie studio maybe 2 years ago, whenever it was that the movie Rising Sun came out by Michael Crichton. Rising Sun was, of course, lots of people said, well, is this good for Japan? Is this bad for Japan? Does it have racist stereotypes? Blah, blah, blah. What I thought was interesting was the role of journalists in that movie, because that movie, like several preceding movies, featured a panel of real-life journalists. They had, I don't know if it was the McLaughlin Group, but some group of real-life journalists was on there making chat. And the interesting thing is that their role in the movie was as stooges, as buffoons. The movie's plot depended on them reaching wrong conclusions, being silly, exaggerating, etc. And this has been the case for several movies in a row. And I thought, these people know how they're going to be cast and still go on. Still, celebrity at any price is worth just this kind of erosion of any respect for the business. And so the accumulation of these things, I had what Ms. Magazine used to call one of those moments of click, where you think, oh no, this all fits together. So it was with one of those moments I said, okay, I'll try to write this book.
One of the larger issues you write about in your book, Breaking the News, is that you think mainstream journalism portrays politics in America as a race to the bottom, in which one group of conniving, insincere politicians ceaselessly tries to outmaneuver another. Give me an example of what you're talking about.
Well, I'll give you The most immediate example, of course, the negotiations over the budget for the last, say, month and a half or 2 months or however long this has been dragging on, because we've heard a lot about this in the papers and over the airwaves, but almost everything we've heard has been, is Newt going to be able to control the freshmen? And has Clinton tricked Newt by making him go too far? And is Clinton lying with his figures? And is Dole going to be caught? And will Graham be able to outmaneuver Dole, et cetera, et cetera? That is descriptions of a part of life that in real life is part of it. You know, part of political life is, of course, maneuver. Part of it is positioning, et cetera, et cetera. Today's politicians, including the president, are not It is not impossible to consider that they are hedging, shading the truth in various ways, but the news presentation has been as if that's the whole story, that if you try to find out what these budget negotiations mean for how your grandparents will fare in their retirement, what kind of taxes you will pay, whether your schools will improve, any of the other things that are of real consequence to people and the way the federal government interacts with them, it's very hard to find those things. I think there is a worse long-term effect, too, which is that the basic role in which all the politicians are cast is as liars. You know, they're all cheating, they're all scheming. And again, if you've dealt with politics, you know that that is part of what they do, but it's not the only thing they do.
Now, wouldn't you say that it's true that in the good newspapers and news magazines, that there have been, you know, long, interesting pieces about the meaning behind the budget negotiations, what the budget will mean for your life and your grandmother's life and so on? People don't necessarily read those pieces, but they're there.
Yes. And what I'm talking about is a matter of emphasis and degree and instinct. And it certainly is true that any news organization, any newspaper or TV network can say, oh, we did that story. We did it on January 5th. And here was here's the long illustration. And yes, you can find counterexamples to what I'm saying if I say it in absolute terms. But as a matter of emphasis, it does seem to me clear that the real instinct in the press on the budget story and the health story before it a year ago is to say, let's spend more time and more of our ingenuity explaining the politics of this than we do explaining the substance. There's a kind of dutifulness and dullness and visit to the school counselor's office tone that comes through a lot of the sort of substance stories. And you can tell the real joy, the real animal spirits are with, let's figure out if Newt really can tame the freshman.
You're in a state of despair over a lot of the political talk shows on television now, and you think that the McLaughlin Group is the show that really set the tone and created this trend. What bugs you about the McLaughlin Group?
Well, I have an actually strangely respectful tone towards John McLaughlin in this book, and I compare him to Christopher Wren, the great architect in England, and the inscription in Latin in Wren's tomb in St. Paul's Cathedral says, I'll just render in English, saying that if you seek his monument, look around you. That is, he influenced the whole landscape. And I think McLaughlin could say the same thing, that if you seek McLaughlin's monument, look around you at the way talk is done in Washington, because he invented something that didn't exist before, this kind of journalist pro-wrestling show. What I think is bad about shows like his is that they reward people very highly, in a way I'll get to in a moment, for traits that are bad for journalism. For example, the structure of these shows is basically like a sitcom. It's like old Leave It to Beaver or whatever, where you have to have a person in each role, where Robert Novak is the curmudgeon and Sam Donaldson is the tart-tongued guy who was always paired off against the stuffy George Will, etc. And predictability should be the opposite of what you want in journalism, but it is necessary in a sitcom way. You're supposed to talk about, on these shows, usually they wrap up the four or five events of the week. Nobody knows in detail about the four or five events, so either they have to fake it and make up things and, you know, sound unduly authoritative, or they have to shrink it to what they do know, which is the politics of Bob Dole versus Bill Clinton. They polarize their views, and maybe most important, if you live a life that is centered around these shows, you can't be a reporter. You have to be in town, you have to be available for the taping, you have to be nice to John McLaughlin, you have to be ready for the speech circuit. And so all the things that should go into being a reporter are at odds with what it takes to become a famous journalist.
James Fallows, have you had much experience being a guest on the Sunday morning shows or any of the other political issue talk shows?
Somewhat. I was on the McLaughlin show either two or three times. I think the last time was in either 1982 or 1983. And after doing it, I thought, I will never do this again. And the reason was I was forced to talk about things I didn't know about. I thought, this is fine, but it's not for me. In the last 5 or 6 years, I have been on the what was then the McNeil Lehrer show a couple of times, twice, I think, on Meet the Press. In each case, when the subject was something that I at least purported to know about, that is, it was about Japan and China type subjects in those times. But I have, for hypocrisy purposes, I should point out that I've done a little bit of this, but in the last 4 or 5 years, I've consciously not done the things which I most complain about.
I mean, are they really knocking on your door to do it?
In the last week, yes.
Well, this is going to put you in a spot. I mean, you're going to want to do a lot of shows to promote your book.
I have already faced this chalice has already come to me. And I there are a number of shows that I will do where I'm going to be talking about something that I know about, that I at least pretend to know about, and I'm not going to be there as a regular. The number of other shows, including the ones I most vehemently criticized, which actually asked and I said no.
Why?
Because I thought it would be hypocritical beyond belief to show up on those shows after complaining about them.
James Fallows is my guest, and his new book is called Breaking the News, How the Media Undermine American Democracy. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with James Fallows. He is Washington editor of The Atlantic magazine and author of the new book, Breaking the News, How the Media Undermine American Democracy. You ask yourself in the book, why do so many journalists want so badly to be regulars on the TV talk shows? And one of the answers you come up with is that TV is the ticket to what is now a very lucrative lecture circuit. And if you're famous, you can make really quite a bit of money going around giving lectures. How is this different than before? Have the stakes really changed in the lecture circuit?
They have changed. There's a difference of degree, and this is the key to the political talk shows. Partly people just like to be on TV in general. It's nice to be noticed. People, your relatives call up and say, hey, I saw you on TV. They rarely say that I agree or disagree, but they saw you, and you have kind of more real presence as a human being. But the economic underpinning of it is that exposure on TV is the way to get onto the corporate lecture circuit, and there is a very great step up in income you can make if you do that, where if you have a number of speeches at somewhere between $15,000 and $35,000 per speech, they add up. And the only way you can get into that market is by being on TV. TV regulars, let's say the TV anchormen, would of course be available for that kind of market, but most of them don't do it on principle. They're well enough paid to begin with, and they just think it would look bad for their networks. So the place where this really hits is with the print journalist who once doesn't have a regular TV outlet, and the way that he or she can really make some money is by getting on one of these talk shows.
You know, there is a movement afoot, including a movement on the part of some congressmen, to require journalists to make public the groups that they accept speaking engagements from, paid speaking engagements. What do you think of that? Do you think that there should be disclosure required of journalists?
Yes, I'm completely in favor of that. I have in the back of my book, I list the places where I have spoken in the last couple of years and where I have gotten money. And I think that it has two benefits. One is it reduces the hypocrisy level, because journalists for the last 15 years have been all over politicians to disclose if they ever took a free taxi ride from somebody, you know, in Dubuque. And so there's a sense that any possible financial corruption can be significant with politicians. Journalists are public figures, too, and I think the same standard can apply to them. The other reason is that if you think you have to reveal something, you're going to think twice before doing it. And I think that would be the real benefit of disclosure. If you think, gee, am I going to want people to know that I got several tens of thousands of dollars from the Philip Morris Company or from the health insurance industry or whatever, you will think hard before doing it. And so that is the real importance of disclosure.
So what effects do you think the direction journalism is having on American democracy? The title of your book is Breaking the News, How the Media Undermine American Democracy. How?
Let me use one I think historic opinion poll as its own answer. The Times Mirror Center, I think it's called the Times Mirror Center for the Study of the People and the Press, or something, released a survey early last year about levels of cynicism about public life, and they found something truly amazing. They found that most journalists were, in their own private belief, not very cynical at all. These people who interacted with politicians over the years knew that politicians could be vain, could be dissembling, etc. But basically, politicians were serious people trying to do things. These journalists, again, in their own private beliefs, felt that there were serious attempts by the Congress and the president to cope with issues, and some things were solved, some things were not. So they did not feel despairing, either about politicians or about the whole process of public life. And yet, the stories that they wrote reflected an entirely different worldview from what they seemed to hold themselves. These stories suggested that all of public life was Newt trying to trick Bill and Bob, and that things never got solved, and it was all a big mess, and it was all a big gridlock, and that the people who read those things and whose knowledge of government was what they saw in the papers and what they saw on TV, they naturally had an extremely cynical and pessimistic view. Cynicism is the problem with having a cynical as opposed to skeptical view is it makes you think, to hell with all of them. You know, all the parties are crooks. They're all going to deceive us. And the problem is somebody is going to rule us year in and year out. And if we all think there's no point in even voting, there's no point in even thinking, the rule we're going to get will be even worse than what we have now.
Do you think that some of your perspective on journalism also comes from having worked as a presidential speechwriter, where you were more involved with the political end of things than the journalistic end?
I'm sure, you know, we are all the product of our long trail of biases and experiences, and I am a product of mine. Probably the thing which amazed me most, although I didn't write about it in this book, is that during the campaign of 1976, candidate Carter gave 7 or 8 speeches on one topic that was never reported, and this topic was inflation. You could argue, number one, that this was the biggest problem of his time in office, apart from the Iranian hostages, that he had the prime rate at 21% or whatever, and that this was how he should have been judged. But each day that he gave this speech on the campaign trail, something else happened. He told Playboy magazine he had lust in his heart, or President Ford ate a tamale with a wrapper on, or something happened that drove the inflation speech out of the news. And so he kept giving again the next week, and again it wouldn't get covered. And this made me think, number one, what it made me think is that you had to be very, very lucky to get a message of substance across, because if there was a chance to write about somebody eating a tamale with a wrapper on, people would seize that chance.
Frank Rich in the New York Times devoted one of his recent columns to your book. He seemed to like the book a lot. He pointed out that there was no index and assumed that was because this way every journalist interested in your book will have to actually read it to find out if they're mentioned by name or not. Was that your motivation in not printing an index?
That was exactly my motivation. Frank Rich perfectly understood what I had in mind, because I have seen too many times people in New York and Washington and other big cities pick up a book, look at the index, you know, start reading it from the back. They look in the index for their name, read that page, and that's it. And my purpose was not simply, although I'm happy to sell books, is not simply to sell books to these people. It was more to make them read and consider part of the argument, you know, not just see exactly the paragraph about them, but to see what the argument is. I recognize my decision may have some harmful side effects to other people who would like to have an index. To them, I say, number one, I'm sorry. Number two, it seemed to me worthwhile on balance. And number three, the paperback edition will have an index.
Our other guest besides you on the show today is Al Franken, political satirist and former cast member of Saturday Night Live. And he has a new satirical book that's called Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations. And he lampoons Limbaugh and Newt Gingrich and the so-called Republican Revolution. What do you think, on a more serious note, of Rush Limbaugh and his impact on journalism?
I think Rush Limbaugh is, number one, an underestimated figure by liberals in general. For my sins, I've listened to his show for years. And the reason I've listened to it is I find it, number one, I found it until recently very entertaining. The guy is a gifted entertainer. And number two, anything that popular deserves some scrutiny, that there's something that he has touched in the public mind that I wanted to know about. So I find him very talented. I think that his influence may be cresting in the last year or two because he has let himself become basically a mouthpiece of Republican Party doctrine. And that is just less entertaining than sort of the free form attack he was doing earlier on. I think his influence on politics has been greater than his influence on journalism. His influence on politics has on balance been deleterious, I think, and not just because I'm a Democrat. I think the deleteriousness has been to he has often put across ideas that simply aren't accurate, to be kind about it. During the health care debate, he was the one who sort of relentlessly pushed the idea that if the health care bill passed, you're going to be put in jail if you went to the wrong doctor. This is going to be some kind of Nazi-like police state. And those became facts, even though they weren't facts. Also, from the day of Bill Clinton's inauguration, he sort of challenged the legitimacy of Clinton's whole election. This was the guy with 43% of the vote. You know, like Clinton or dislike Clinton, he was the president. He had the same percentage that Nixon did when he came in. And there was this sort of inherent cynicism. His effect in journalism, I think most journalists have tried to sort of ignore the importance of Limbaugh and consign him to some alternative universe and not learn either good or bad lessons from him. The one good lesson to be learned from him is the value of entertainment, of making things interesting, of making them funny. And at his best, he's a very funny guy.
Yeah, but the Sunday talk shows that you've put down are trying to be entertaining, too, and you don't like them for that.
That's a legitimate point for you to make, and I think the difference I would say is there's I'll use the example of Al Franken, who you know I agree with politically, and I think is tremendously funny. Al Franken does not present himself as being a journalist. It's not Al Franken, you know, columnist for the Washington Post or Al Franken, congressman. It's Al Franken, entertainer. And part of the problem with Sunday talk shows is this confusion of realms. You have a journalist and a congressman or a senator sitting right next to each other arguing as if they were equals in some way. And this makes you wonder, you know, who is what? It's not the purity of the journalist's role that I worry about. Oh, well, people think they are biased in some way. It's rather that people just begin to sort of, they have no clear sense of what information they're getting from where. Is the journalist who's giving this column, is he just another politician running for office? Are these people all indistinguishable characters from the great TV land, which is the most important realm in America, or what? So I make special allowance for people who don't pretend to be journalists like either Al Franken or Rush Limbaugh.
James Fallows, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
James Fallows is the author of Breaking the News, How the Media Undermine American Democracy. He's Washington editor of The Atlantic Monthly and a regular contributor to NPR's Morning Edition. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, political satirist Al Franken on the leaders of the Republican Revolution. He's written a new book called Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations. Franken is a former cast member of Saturday Night Live. Also, a new Buddy Holly tribute album. This is Fresh Air. I'm Jerry Gross. Al Franken has spent much of his adult life working on Saturday Night Live as a writer, performer, and producer. But he recently left the show, so his latest political satires are in a new book. It's called Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations. Some of those other observations have to do with Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. Here's Franken reading the chapter, The Newt Cancer Surgery Story, What the Liberal Media Might Not Be Telling You.
You've probably heard the famous story about Newt Gingrich and his first wife, Jackie, the one in which he visited her in a hospital when she was recovering from cancer surgery. As the story goes, Gingrich brought along their two daughters and a yellow legal pad with his terms for a divorce, which he read to her while she was still groggy. Now, one thing you should know about the story is this. It's true. Gingrich has acknowledged all but the groggy part, telling Time magazine that the story was a bit of a caricature. And to be fair, there is no way to know what goes on between two people. Anyone who's been married knows that. In fact, I think the liberal media's portrayal of this whole ugly episode has been a little unfair to Newt. Maybe if we knew the real story, Newt wouldn't come out looking like such a pig. Maybe it went like this. Jackie calls Newt at home just before she goes into surgery. Newt, I'm more certain than ever that I want a divorce. But honey, you're about to undergo cancer surgery. You don't know what you're saying. Newt, please. When you bring the girls today, I also want you to bring a legal pad with terms for a divorce. For God's sakes, you're having cancer surgery. Would you stop it, Newt? This is what I want. What I don't want is for you to blame yourself. You're too good a person for that. It could have been like that, and to assume otherwise would be unfair. Of course, what we do know is that after the divorce, he was late with his alimony payments, and she had to take him to court twice to provide adequate support for her and the girls, and that her church took up a collection to help them get by. That we do know.
Al Franken, that's an excerpt of your new book, Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between writing a book of political satire, your first book of that sort, and doing a political sketch for Saturday Night Live?
Well, I was very frightened when I started this book because I didn't know if I could write in a voice,
mm-hmm.
you know. And when you do a sketch, what really drives sketch comedy are the characters. So at Saturday Night Live, we were fortunate to have people like Dana Carvey could do Bush and Chevy did Ford and Dan Aykroyd did Nixon and Carter. So it was really around that performance. And this was very frightening to me because I had to find out if I had a voice to write in, and I think I succeeded.
Why did you give your book the title that you did, Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations? Why Rush Limbaugh in the title?
Well, first of all, he is really fat. But why Rush? He really was, he was called the majority maker by the freshman members of Congress and was made an honorary member of the class of 94. So I sort of felt that I could use his views as a way of explaining the Republican Revolution. And he's become a mouthpiece, really, for the freshmen and for the Gingrich wing of the party. So I thought it might sell some books.
More importantly, right?
Yeah. So as soon as I thought of the title, Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations, and then that was the first thing I did on this book, and then I took a month off. Because I said, hey, I got a good title. and my publisher really liked the title, but my editor called back after thinking about it a week. She said, legal says, you might have to change the title. We might not be able to use that. And I said, well, he's a public figure. She goes, well, yeah, but they say you really have to write about Rush Limbaugh then. And I go, well, that's my intention. So the book is, I sort of use Rush as a way of explaining, this new Republican Congress and also some of the presidential candidates. I go into a lot of different things, but Rush is throughout the book.
When did you first start listening to Rush Limbaugh and how did you start?
Well, I think I heard him first in a cab in New York. And the first time I ever heard him on the radio, he was ranting about feminazis and how feminists believe that all heterosexual sex is rape, and which I admit is a very hard viewpoint to defend. The thing is, though, know a lot of women, all of whom consider themselves feminists, and only one holds this view, and we've been married nearly 20 years.
Right.
So that's the first time I listened. And then I started tuning him in every once in a while, and then I started watching his show. And I was just amazed at sort of the disinformation that he was putting out.
Yes, you've actually concluded that part of the point of his show is to punish you for actually knowing anything.
Yes.
How did you reach that conclusion?
Well, the first time I saw his TV show, I write about this in the book, it was the day after President Bush, this is like in October of 92, Bush had appeared on Larry King and said some things about Clinton organizing protests in Great Britain during the war and saying, I don't know, you know, it makes me uncomfortable organizing demonstrations while, you know, your countrymen are dying in another country. I just don't like it. It just doesn't sit well with me. So the next day, the New York Times ran a headline saying Bush questions Clinton's patriotism. And so Rush is on the next night, and he holds up this headline and goes, like, I listened to this interview, and he never questioned his patriotism. Here, let's watch. And then he shows a clip from the Larry King interview, a 20-second clip from a totally different part of the interview. And then we'll be right back. And he says, did you hear one question of Clinton's brave patriotism? This is a typical example of the liberal media and how they bend the truth. And the only way you're going to get the truth is from me. And then we'll be right back. And then cut to his, you know, audience of right-wing geeks applauding madly. And what's interesting about him and his listeners who proudly call themselves ditto heads because they agree with everything he says. There was this study done at the Annenberg School on people on how they get their news. And this was done during the healthcare debate. And they asked people get their news either from, you know, news primarily from newspapers or from TV news, or there were some people, a group of people who got their news primarily from talk radio, and those people primarily got it from Rush Limbaugh. So they asked all these different people, all these groups, how well informed they felt they were, they thought they were. And the people who got their news from talk radio and primarily from Rush rated themselves as the best informed. Then they tested the people objectively on how well they were informed by asking them questions of fact about the healthcare debate. And the Limbaugh listeners were the least informed, objectively. So I asked the person who ran this study, I said, well, how is this possible that the people who consider themselves the most informed are actually the least informed? And she said, well, a social scientist called it pseudo-certainty. And, you know, I call it being a cretin, is what I call it. But anyway, so what he does is he lies a lot. I was going to call the book Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Liar and Other Observations, but that just seems so confrontational. And he misleads a lot by omitting very, very important things.
When you look at Rush Limbaugh, does he, let me put it this way, you know how sometimes you look at somebody and you feel like you knew them when you were in grade school or high school, or mm-hmm. you knew somebody just like them? Do you ever feel that way looking at Rush Limbaugh? And if so, does he remind you of a particular person?
I don't think so. I mean, he reminds you of a type of person. You know, I say Rush attacks women a lot. You know, he says that feminism was created so that ugly women could take a place in the mainstream of society. And he, you know, has been criticized for that and keeps defending having said that. He actually said that and means it. And I was trying to figure out why he gets away with this, and I sort of think that he gets away with attacking women because he's obviously such a sort of a sad, fat, pathetic loser who's had such a tough time with women that people kind of feel sorry for him. And, you know, he's been married 3 times and met his third wife on the internet. I'm taunting him. Come on, Rush.
Do you want Rush Limbaugh to engage you in public debate?
If he had a milliliter of testosterone in his body, he'd come after me. No, I sent, we sent him a book.
No, you know what he'd say?
What?
You're not important enough.
Oh, yeah, that'd be good. I sent him a book. My publisher sent him a letter, which I dictated, which was, Dear Rush, Al feels it would help sales if you mentioned the book on your show.
That's good.
Yeah. We haven't heard from him.
You do a lot of political humor, and specific people are often targets of your humor. So you have to deal a lot with questions of taste. What's tasteful? What's tasteless? What's too mean to say?
Mm-hmm. Well, I call this book Mean but Uncompromisingly Fair.
Translated?
Well, you know, what I did was I sort of... Part of this is a satire on the breakdown in the civility of public discourse. And I sort of do it by using the methods that Limbaugh and Gingrich and GOPAC, which was Gingrich's political action committee, used. They're in a letter to their candidates, the Republican candidates, Gingrich offered this advice. Go negative early. Use small details to demonize your opponents and never, never try to educate, which is really odd because he always talks about being a teacher. So that's, I sort of am trying to hold them accountable for their techniques and their methods and be funny about it.
My guest is Al Franken. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with political satirist Al Franken. His new book is called Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations. Al Franken, you have to deal with questions of taste all the time. And
yes.
Sometimes I'd imagine right before going on, you're even thinking in your mind, should I do this joke or not? In fact, I know that happened one time because you write about it in your book at a White House correspondents' dinner where, you know, the president and the first lady and the vice president are all in the audience. And you're deciding what joke to lead off with and whether it's going to be too tasteless or not. This was the day after Nixon's death. What was the joke you were thinking of telling and weren't sure about?
Well, Nixon had died the night before, and I was just in my mind going, do I tell a joke about this? And I have some friends who are Washington friends, and Jonathan Alter from Newsweek said, oh, yeah, you got to do a Nixon joke. Everyone's going to be expecting you to do something. And I went to Norm Ornstein, who's with the American Enterprise Institute, and he said, you'd be insane to do a Nixon joke. So during dinner, I spoke after dinner. I'm going, what should I do? And the joke I was going to do was, you know, I was feeling pretty good yesterday because I had 10 minutes of dynamite Nixon material. But that was a joke I didn't tell. I decided not to do. There was also a joke that I didn't tell about the vice president, which was, before the dinner, there's a cocktail party for the people on the dais, which include the president and the first lady and the vice president and Tipper. So I had this joke about the vice president. And I went up to Tipper, and I was really worried about it because I didn't want to cross the line. So I went up to Tipper, and I said, I have this joke about your husband, and my instinct tells me not to tell it, that it's over the line. She said, well, what's the joke? I said, okay, well, here's the joke. Vice President Gore continued to show his commitment to the environment by announcing today that he's going to change the policy on the stick up his butt. Instead of replacing the stick every day with a new stick, the vice president will keep the same stick up his butt for the rest of the administration.
What was Tipper's reaction to this?
Well, she looked at me, just kind of looked at me and just said, like I was crazy, and said, I would go with your instinct.
So you didn't tell it?
I didn't tell the joke.
So what did you open with?
I opened with this joke, which it's a tremendous honor to be asked to speak here at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, to speak before the president, the first lady, the vice president, Mrs. Gore, Wolf Blitzer. I got a nice laugh, proving my theory that Wolf Blitzer is a funny name.
Now, you read in your book that you got Ron Nessen, former White House press secretary, to host Saturday Night Live while President Ford was in office. Mm-hmm. And it turned out just being a disaster for Ford.
Right.
What were some of the worst moments from Ford's perspective?
Well, this is the kind of thing where Nessen came in, and we sort of expected him to be very concerned about what we were doing, and he didn't seem concerned at all. So we had, let me find in the book, because this is a list of stuff. Do you mind if I do that?
No.
Well, how can you mind? Let's see. Well, you know, in the book, I do these sort of, as you know, I do these adventures in politics, which are sort of, you know, my experiences in politics, and this is one of them. Is getting okay. Oh yeah, yeah. Well, there was an Oval Office sketch in which Nessen appeared playing himself, and Chevy Chase played Ford, doing things like stapling his ear and kicking a wastebasket and saying "Heel Liberty" to a stuffed dog. There were sketches which Nessen didn't appear in which there's one which Chevy and Jane Curtin were writhing under sheets in their bedroom as robed Supreme Court justices made sure that they weren't doing anything too kinky. There's an Emily Latella sketch that Gilda did, or piece that she did about presidential erections. And then there was this hilarious parody of the, with a name like Smuckers, It Has to Be Good commercial written by Michael Donahue, and it had names for jams like Nose Hair, Death Camp, Mangled Baby Ducks, Dog Vomit, Monkey Pus, and Painful Rectal Itch. And the greatest part about this is that Nessen had convinced the president to open the show with a live from New York on Saturday night. So it was kind of his, like, presidential endorsement of our show. Oh, yeah, and I forgot there was the Autumn Fizz parody, which Gilda pitched a carbonated douche. So the White House staffers were not, and the president were not pleased.
Well, what was the moral of the story for you at Saturday Night Live, that you should do this again or never do this again?
Well, you know, at SNL, we had, you know, I'm not there anymore, but they still have the policy, which is a host, you want to try to make the host look good. And a host, we never, ever force a host to do anything he or she doesn't want to do. And that's only because you want the host to look good because you want to get hosts. You don't want people not to want to do the show. So all it really taught me was basically that Nessen didn't have was not really looking out, you know, for the president, I don't think, there. Maybe he was just trying to be a good sport or something like that. So I didn't really learn a lesson at all. Now that I think about it, it was just, you know, if I ever in that situation, you know, if you visit a show, you have to take care of yourself, but you also have to trust people. So it's a delicate balance.
You know, we've talked a little about what it's been like for you to consider telling a joke to the wrong audience or a joke at the wrong time. You've also been in the position of being misinterpreted when you've said something, and you talk about that a little bit in your book. I'll tell a story of what you said at the Harvard John F. Kennedy School of Government when you were talking to students there and did a Q&A session with them after your talk.
Yeah, I went to, a couple years ago, I was invited to go to the JFK School, and there was this huge crowd, standing room only. And the day before, or some, I think it was a couple days before, the speaker had been the editor of the only opposition newspaper in El Salvador, and six people came to his thing. And mine was standing room only because I'd worked with John Belushi. So, you know, the show has always been considered something of a white male bastion. You know, except for maybe the Eddie Murphy years. So somebody in the question and answers got up and said, "Why don't you hire more minorities?" And I said, "Well, you know, we have, you know, two very funny people, Tim Meadows and Ellen Cleghorn, are cast members, and Rob Schneider is half Jewish and half Filipino, if that's any help, you know." And this person wouldn't stop and kept badgering me about this. And finally, I just said, well, also, one reason is that minorities just aren't funny. And there's like 500 people there or 300 people, whatever it was. And they all laugh. Even the guy asking the question laughed. So the next day in the Harvard Crimson, it's reported that Al Franken at this thing said that minorities just aren't funny. And it was sort of like, you know, I know how irony, this is why I can never be a politician, because irony is, it can, it looks really bad in print and cold type.
Al Franken, his new book of political satire is called Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations. Coming up, a Buddy Holly tribute record. This is Fresh Air. A new album called Not Fade Away presents a wide range of contemporary pop musicians paying their respects to Buddy Holly. The album features tributes by performers ranging from Mary Chapin Carpenter to the Mavericks, from Dave Edmonds to the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. Here's the Mavericks doing Holly's True Love Ways.
Just you know why. Why you. Well, by and by, no true love waits. Sometimes we sigh.
Buddy Holly remains one of rock and roll's most influential songwriters and performers nearly 40 years after his death. The Beatles covered Holly's song Words of Love. The Rolling Stones did a menacing version of Not Fade Away. Over the past few years, there have been a slew of albums in which well-known pop stars salute an older influence. Everyone from Leonard Cohen to Harry Nilsson has been honored in this way with decidedly mixed results. Too often, these well-meaning efforts have resulted in self-indulgent, slipshod music, but that's not true of this collection. Just listen to the way Nancy Griffith bears down on the words of Well, All Right. She's backed by members of Buddy Holly's band, The Crickets.
Well, all right, so I'm being foolish. Well, all right, let the people know about the dreams and wishes you wish in the night when the lights are low. Well, all right, well, all right, we'll live in love with all our might. Well, all right, our lifetime love will be all right.
As usual with this sort of album, the tracks that work least well are the ones that try to sound most like the original. This notion is carried to a silly extreme on a version of Peggy Sue Got Married, in which Holly's original vocals are combined with those of Graham Nash and a reformed version of Nash's 60s group, The Hollies. It's a cute little drag. By contrast, one of the best pieces of music here is from Steve Earle and country singer Marty Stewart, who rip through Crying, Waiting, Hoping in their own rough way.
Crying, waiting, get you off my mind. Right, waiting, hoping you come back. You're the one I love, and I think about you all the time.
The oldest performer included on this collection was a contemporary, collaborator, and pal of Buddy Holly's, Waylon Jennings. More than 35 years ago, Jennings clapped his hands to provide the beat for Holly's recording of You're the One, and Jennings was supposed to be on the airplane flight in 1959 that ended in the crash that killed Holly, Ritchie Valens, and the Big Bopper. Here, backed by Dire Straits' Mark Knopfler on guitar, Waylon Jennings offers a beautifully somber version of Learning the Game.
Hearts that are broken and love that's untrue, these go with learning the game. When you love her and she doesn't love you, you're only learning the game. When she says that you're the only one she'll ever love, then you find that you are not the one she's thinking of.
For a long time, Buddy Holly was enshrined as a sensitive soul whose sense of both melody and propriety supposedly prevented him from falling into the sort of rebellious pose that made Elvis Presley seem so threatening. But well-thought-out collections like this one remind us that Holly was actually very much in touch with his wilder, woolier side. If it does nothing more than confirm the idea that Holly was in fact a complete rock and roller, fully formed in the duration of his all-too-brief career, this collection will have served its purpose well.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Not Fade Away, a new Buddy Holly tribute album. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, Al Banks, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Phoebe Vanskoy. Roberta Shirock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Maybe, baby, I'll have you. Maybe, baby. Maybe, baby, I'll have you for me. It's funny, honey, you don't care. You never listen to my prayer. Maybe, baby, you will love me someday. Oh, well, you are the one that makes me glad. Any other one will just make me sad. And when someday you want me, well, I'll be there, wait and see. Maybe, baby.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.